welcome to this week's History Now. Today we've got a very special guest, a very distinguished historian, Professor Diarmaid Farrador from University College Dublin, who'll be here to talk about his two books, On the Edge and On the Border. So Diarmaid, you're in a kind of unique position that you've got two books out at the minute. On the Edge, about Ireland's offshore islands, and The Border. We'll go on to The Border in a minute. But just give us a bit of, how did that come about? How did you manage the two books in such a short space of time?
Well, the Islands book is an idea that I've been working on for a long time. It's been gestating very slowly, and I'd been researching different parts of it at different stages. I had a personal interest in the Islands, partly because my family originally would have been from West Kerry. And I remember very vividly as a child going out to the Blasket Islands, which really captured my imagination, and being intrigued at the idea that there had been a thriving community on what was now an abandoned island. And I always had that interest, and the more I became interested in history as I got older, the more interested I got in exploring what those lives must have been like, but also linking the island themes to wider themes associated with modern Irish history, including the idea of people living on the margins and the gulf between rhetoric and reality, and just how the great promises that were there about sustaining an indigenous way of life, how those promises were dashed. And when I went on to work on an exhibition to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the foundation of the Free State in 1997, I actually began the exhibition on Tory Island because I found a file in 1922 from a priest who was administering to the Tory Islanders, and he was writing about the desperate straits that they were in and the difficult circumstances, a population of 350, and he suggested 2/3 of them were destitute. And he posed this question: who in power is big enough to devise a scheme to save the islands? And there, at the very outset of the state, was the big question about the island communities and about whether or not their way of life could survive and whether their way of living could be sustained. And I wanted to explore that as an island question, but also related to the wider challenges of independence. So it really was about bringing those strands together and exploring the reasons why so many of them became depopulated.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is the dichotomy between rhetoric and reality, and that's because you talked about a great failure of the revolutionary generation. Obviously, they were all, you know, sort of emphasizing linguistic and cultural purity, and that kind of, you know, it didn't materialize. When did that sort of romantic view of the islanders and the islands dissipate?
Well, the islands are really discovered in a cultural sense in the second half of the 19th century because various people started making pilgrimages to the islands, you know, anthropologists and sociologists, ethnographers, and of course, those who saw themselves as cultural purists, including those who became part of the revolutionary generation, and they tended to depict the islands as being the essence of Irishness, as repositories of a pure form of Irish identity and kind of vestiges of an undivided nation. They do romanticize them. Mm-hmm. They're quite sincere and genuine in their devotion, and many make the trip out to the islands, particularly to learn the Irish language on places like the Aran Islands, where the language was regarded as so pure and beautifully spoken. And the challenge, once you reach the early 1920s, is whether or not they're going to match this romanticism and this rhetoric with practical economic support. Mm-hmm. And they don't, to the extent that was needed. If you consider the situation of the islands under British rule, a lot of improvements had come about as a result of the Congested Districts Board, which was established in 1891 for those impoverished areas of the western part of the country in particular. And that led to quite significant improvements in housing and attempts to try and build indigenous agricultural industry. There was some success, and the islands did benefit from that. But the Congested Districts Board is wound down mm-hmm. in the early 1920s, and by 1924 it's gone. And the crucial point is it's not replaced by something new. There is no island authority. There is no obvious body that takes responsibility for the islands. And responsibility for the islands tends to be distributed across a whole range of government departments, with the result that they fall between all the stools of those departments. And there's no one really speaking for them. That proves to be very frustrating for many of the islanders. It's often island tragedies that bring the islands into the public domain. and generates a debate and discourse about them. The Cleggan disaster in 1927, when 44 fishermen were killed in one night, many of them breadwinners from the islands, and it devastated them. It led to the evacuation eventually of the Inishkeys the following decade in the 1930s, the Mayo Islands. And it really highlighted the difficulties and the plight of that living on the edge and the precariousness of their existence. But even state support for fisheries, which is such a mainstay of island work, that was sorely lacking as well. I mean, the Irish Department of Fisheries was only a junior government department in the 1920s. It only had a budget of about £25,000 in 1925. And there were only about 1,000 full-time fishermen in Ireland in the 1920s, compared to 65,000 in the 1820s. So that whole fishing industry really had been decimated, and there wasn't much support from the 1920s onwards. It's not that the islands were completely ignored. I mean, the government did devise certain schemes in relation to trying to bring a degree of modernization to the islands and improving access and credit supply schemes, electricity as you go on through the decades. But ultimately, they could not provide islanders with the same standard of life and quality of living and the same services as on the mainland. And of course, many believed that it just wasn't practical or feasible. But again, you have to put that alongside the continued idealization of island living. Even you can see that in the film Man of Arran, Robert Flaherty's famous film, which again was embraced by politicians in the 1930s as being a brilliant representation of stoic Irish self-reliance and the continuity of an ancient and noble tradition. But of course, the reality for most of the islanders is that they had to make a life for themselves as adults off the islands, and that continued. Some of them survived as populated islands, but many more didn't, and there's a very dramatic decline. People will be very familiar with the evacuation of the Blaskets in the early 1950s, but there were other islands that didn't achieve the same prominence that were slowly and quietly being depopulated.
Yeah, just a follow on from the, you know, the politicians and their lionization of the of this. Charlie Hockey in 1981, you mentioned that in the postscript of the book, how he is still sort of beating that drum in 1981, talking about the Blaskets when they were evacuated for 30 years at that point. Was that just to, you know, win votes, things like that?
Hockey had a very strong sense of himself. And he had this notion that he could return to an ancient seat, Inishvikalan, in West Kerry, that he could become an island chieftain, an island king, essentially. And he's very interested in that cultural side and the cultural history of the islands. But he has such a strong sense of self that he wants to recreate this idea of him being at the centre of the essence of Irishness. Now, the irony, of course, is that in order to do that, he has to spend considerable sums of money and make sure he lives in a degree of opulence and comfort which had never been available to island communities. So it's mixed in with that wider sense of Charles Haughey's ego and mission to be very, very comfortable indeed. But I suppose the irony is that in doing what he did, buying the island originally and then building this palatial pad, at the same time he was talking about what the Blaskets represented in Irish culture. But he was celebrating them and heralding them at a time when the islands had been evacuated. And it was way too late to be talking about the intrinsic value of the islands to Irish culture, way too late to be using the rhetoric associated with a thriving culture, when many were seeing them by that stage as relics of an ancient past, and also as reminders of great mistakes that had been made by Haughey's predecessors.
Yeah, we're most familiar with the Blasket literature of Peg Sayers, people like that. There, did that give the islands a boost in the public consciousness in a way that wasn't there before?
Oh, there's no doubt that the Blasket literature made sure that the island heritage and knowledge about the islands and what they represented was kept very much in the public domain. Tomás O'Crihan's An Tillánach, the Island Man, was the first of them. And he was making the point that he wanted to capture the essence of a life that was gone or that was on its way out. Peg Sayers, of course, did likewise. Mearshall Sullivan, Fiche Bliain Fáil, 20 Years of Growing. And they became very famous as Blasket authors. But there were also senior academics who discovered the Blaskets as the best place to learn the language and to appreciate that Irish heritage and the culture and linguistic history associated with the islands. And they pushed for there to be a greater awareness and greater knowledge about what the islands represented. So it did bring this intense focus to the Blaskets in particular. But even that was not enough to save the island. You know, producing very well received books from such a tiny population, a tiny island population, was a fascinating story in itself, but it wasn't going to butter parsnips. And you can see in parallel with that Blasket literature, the internal government documents that underline the bleak reality facing an island whose young people do not want to stay there because they don't see any future there and are emigrating. And eventually there were more Blasket Islanders in Massachusetts than there were on the Blasket Islands, and many of them made that journey over to Springfield. So that became the trajectory for many islanders, that they could only sustain a living abroad. So that fame that was achieved by the Blaskets, whilst it secured the Blaskets' place in history and in memory and in popular culture, it couldn't, you know, create a viable future for the islands alone.
So move on to your new book, The Border. Usually when I have an author in who's got a new book, I'll ask them what was their reason for choosing such a topic. But I think we're all well aware that, and it's not often that an historian gets this opportunity to the hot political and historical topic of the day.
Well, it really struck me, arising out of the Brexit referendum in June 2016, that there was a lot of ignorance about the border. There was a lot of ignorance about the border in England. There was also arguably a lot of ignorance about the border in Ireland. And I wanted to put some kind of a context on it, and I wanted to explain the reason for its emergence and its evolution. And obviously I had also been thinking in the context of the coming centenary of the creation of the state of Northern Ireland and what the border represented in 1920 and 1921, not just for Ireland, but for the wider imperial project and where it fits into the whole history of the post-World War I international dispensation, you know, disputed boundaries and states, new states being forged, and how we could make sense of that. But also to underline that if you wanted to understand why, say, the backstop issue had become such an intractable issue and so contentious, if you wanted to understand that, you did need to understand the history of the border. There needed to be an appreciation that it was complex and multi-layered. There needed to be an appreciation as well that it was not just a contentious political issue. It was an economic issue, it was a cultural issue, it was about sociology, it was about disrupted lives. And for me, it was also about whether there was a sense of a border people and a border community. Because for all of the abstract talk about the border and its meandering complexity, and, you know, in economic and geographic terms, it was quite a ridiculous border because it was so porous and so long and so extensive and so difficult to manage. I did want to focus also on those who had to deal with that as part of their everyday lives in a very, very practical sense. And there's very interesting social history there. There's a fascinating history of smuggling associated with the border. There's also a contested identity for border people. Where do they belong? Do they belong to the border itself? Do they belong on one side of the border or the other side of the border? You know, how would they characterize their own identity? Mm-hmm. So there were all those ingredients in the cauldron of the border. And obviously I, like many, was very dispirited by some of the clearly ignorant assertions that were being made, particularly by senior conservative politicians and Brexiteers, about the border. And it did underline to me that there was a serious gap in their knowledge and also an almost willful ignorance. One of the great ironies of all of the focus on the border in the last 2 years is that it did not receive adequate attention at all during the referendum campaign. What became the most difficult issue was not properly aired or discussed or considered. And it's a reminder of that difficulty that has always been there about trying to impress upon a British audience the importance of the legacy of that period of history. And it's the weight of that legacy that we're still dealing with today.
It's really interesting. I just thought there now of something that Declan Cabard said, that there's ignorance about history in some parts of England because most of their history happened in other countries. You know?
Well, it's also about the exit strategies, you know, the imperial exit strategies. What happens when Britain extricates itself or attempts to extricate itself from a place that it has presided over, has colonised? What mess is left behind? This is not just true, of course, of Ireland. I was interested in looking at what happened in India, what happened in Palestine. And there's quite a mess, of course, left behind, and partition can be one of the consequences of that. Now, you also have to appreciate, of course, that 100 years ago, Britain faced a dilemma about how to respond to an intractable Irish problem and the desire of Ulster Unionists in particular to remain a part of the United Kingdom at a time when three quarters of the island roughly had voted for Sinn Féin in the December 1918 election. Was Britain going to recognise that mandate? Clearly it wasn't. It wasn't going to recognise a mandate for an Irish Republic. So what do they do in looking at their Irish question? And clearly the thinking on David Lloyd George's part, the Prime Minister at the time of partition, was that I have to sort out my Ulster problem before I can deal with my wider Irish problem. And it was Walter Long, not a household name, a former leader of the Unionists, who began looking in detail in 1919, exactly 100 years ago, at what a partition solution might look like. The interesting thing is that it was framed as something that should be temporary. The idea of the Government of Ireland acting, creating two parliaments for Ireland, which Ulster Unionists accepted, Sinn Féin obviously didn't in the south. The idea was that Ireland would eventually work out its own salvation, that Britain was keen for the two parts of Ireland to come together. And I think that was genuine. For practical reasons, because they wanted to get the Irish question off the table of Downing Street, David Lloyd George was not particularly ideologically engaged with either side. He had some very revealing things to say in private about Ulster Unionists, who he found a pugnacious people. He said in the early 1920s that the feeling here is not as strong as it was in 1913, 1914. In other words, we're not going to back them to the extent that we did in opposing the Third Home Rule Bill. But he was also speaking out of both sides of his mouth about partition by insisting when speaking to Sinn Féin that this was just going to be a temporary partition, that ultimately they would come up with a scheme that would make Northern Ireland unviable, what ultimately became the Boundary Commission, that it would result in large-scale transfers of territory from north to south to make Northern Ireland unviable. That was swallowed by a lot of Sinn Féiners at the time. Whilst he was, at the same time, David Lloyd George was reassuring Unionists that they had nothing to fear from any settlement he might come to with Southern Ireland. So there was trickery going on, there's no doubt about that. But there was also James Craig, as the first Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, being in quite a strong position in refusing to engage in dialogue with London and Sinn Féin in the context of an All-Ireland solution in 1921 during the treaty negotiations, and then insisting what we have, we hold. And the border hardened from a very early stage. But that wasn't just about Ulster Unionist intransigence. It was also about the economic policies of the Free State, because the Free State imposed customs tariffs in April 1923, and so began the economic divide. And that hardened, of course, over time. So the border becomes entrenched very quickly. The logic behind opting for six-county exclusion from the Unionist perspective was that that was the area that they could control with an inbuilt two-thirds majority. A nine-county Ulster, the whole province would have been much more difficult and much more complicated. But there's also a very crude drawing of the boundary, because they adhere to the original county lines. There were various proposals on the table that they might look at parliamentary constituencies or local government areas to decide on the border, but they opted for the county lines, which were established originally in the 16th and the 17th century. Often along rivers, and of course around that significant habitation and commercial activity had built up. So when they come to impose the border in the early 1920s, they're often cutting through farms, in some cases even individual houses and villages, you know, bridges representing two sides of the border. So it's very crude. Obviously, it's very long. And from the earliest stages, there are serious complications in relation to how you police it.
Yeah.
Many Northern Nationalists feel abandoned and betrayed from the earliest stages. In 1925, Cathair Healy, who was the Sinn Féin MP for Tyrone and Fermanagh in the early 1920s, he insisted that Northern Nationalists had been sold into political servitude for all time. It was a very dramatic declaration, and it encapsulated that sense of betrayal and abandonment. And that lasts. And even in the 1950s, Northern Nationalists like Eddie McAteer and Paddy Maxwell are banging on the doors of Dáil Éireann in Dublin, the Irish Parliament, and asking for representation and to be heard. And the door is slammed in their faces. And the way Eddie McAteer puts it in the 1950s, you don't want to hear any reproachful voices that disturb your comfort in Dublin. Despite your rhetoric about reclaiming the fourth green field and ending partition.
There's a really interesting point that you make about Frank Aiken, about what is his naivety around the border. And that sort of, you know, that kind of seems a bit, you know, ridiculous given he was from Camlagh. So can you tell us, in your book you say that he almost disregards five decades of Irish history.
We have to understand it's emotional as much as it's political. I mean, Frank Aiken was a native of Armagh. He had served, obviously, in the Northern Division of the IRA during the War of Independence, associated with some very controversial episodes too during that period and into the Civil War. And Frank Aiken was obviously frequently seen as a hard man of the IRA and subsequently became a very long-serving Minister for External Affairs. What struck me about his memoranda in the 1950s was the obsession he had with the moral superiority of the Southern Irish case against partition. And I have described him as being quite callow and almost childlike in how he framed his opposition. Perhaps that's a bit unfair to him given all the baggage that he was carrying. But at the same time, you can see a consistent inability to understand an Ulster Unionist mindset, which was never going to achieve much politically for Southern Nationalists if they couldn't bridge that gap. De Valera was quite similar. The idea was that Britain had imposed partition, therefore it was up to Britain to undo partition. And Frank Aiken argued in the 1950s that if Britain made a declaration that it would not stand in the way of a united Ireland, well then we could do business with the Ulster Unionists, as if that would solve the problem. That did seem to be exceptionally naive. And there was that idea as well in the 50s, and Aiken often articulates this, that Ireland has done so much for Western civilization, we deserve not to be divided. And again, that's all well and good if you're preoccupied with your own sense of righteousness. But again, you're ignoring the obvious difficulty of unionist opposition to a united Ireland. So there is a reluctance to engage with that. There's very little dialogue. And there is a reliance on this mantra that Britain needs to undo what Britain has done. Now, what that didn't recognise, of course, is that partition was born with the assistance of Irish midwives also. And there were those within the Fianna Fáil party, including Sean McEntee, who was a Belfast Catholic, who got very frustrated with this kind of language. Even from the 1930s, he's insisting we have subordinated reason to prejudice, that we're relying on Britain's big stick and it will fail. And he was right about that. But it takes others quite a long time to come to that point. Lamasque does come to that point at an earlier stage than some of his colleagues, even though he will still bang the traditional anti-partition drum when it suits him to connect with his grassroots. He does try and take some of the heat out of the situation. He tells his cabinet in 1959, gentlemen, there will always be a Northern Ireland. And even using that description, Northern Ireland, was in itself an advance on what had been there previously. Because you note from the terminology that it's frequently referred to as the six counties or the northeast. They don't want to give it recognition as a state. So there are subtle changes there, and there is a focus from Lamasque on the idea of economic cooperation and areas that are not as contentious.
Your book brings us through the Troubles, brings us through the 1980s onwards, where we see talks coming on. But if we bring it forward to your final chapter, which covers a lot of what's happening in the last 2 years, how do you approach that from, you know, something that's fairly static and what you can go and look at, and but then something that's very fluid right up until this very day, this very morning? What challenge did that pose?
Well, the last chapter, which is about Brexit, brinkmanship and backstops, was as much a current affairs challenge as it was a historical challenge. You still want to keep the historical context and draw parallels with what was happening 100 years ago, particularly in relation to the Irish question being a complicating factor in British politics, and also some English politicians using the Irish issue as a pawn in what was a distinctly English power game and has been an English power game over the last couple of years. So you can see the continuities and the need for the historical perspective. But you also have to untangle that complicated web of current affairs, because there's been an awful lot of hot air as well, particularly in relation to the so-called constitutional integrity of the United Kingdom or the constitutional purity of the United Kingdom. There seems to be developing a mantra that Northern Ireland could not be treated differently. Mm-hmm. This is coming from both Brexiteers and the DUP in particular. And that flew in the face of the history that I had been looking at, because Northern Ireland had always been treated differently. And of course, with the Good Friday Agreement, Northern Ireland was being treated differently again. And there was the idea that Northern Ireland could exercise a degree of self-determination, and that you repeal the 1920 Government of Ireland Act, and we had entered a new phase. So it was about, that last chapter was partly about trying to underline that an awful lot of the rhetoric that we've heard over the last 2 years has been grossly misleading, and again, willfully ignorant. There was also a tendency for senior Brexiteers to insist that the Irish question or the Irish border question was a trivial issue, was a sideshow, was not as complicating as we were pretending it was. Pure millennium bug stuff, according to Boris Johnson. Now, you can see how that would raise the hackles of those who were affected by the border, and those whose livelihoods are very much bound up with the continued existence of a soft border. So I was trying to unpick some of what I felt was the dishonesty around it and the ignorance, but also then to highlight the danger of accepting reassurances. And again, there are lessons from history in this. You know, the same text can be interpreted in different ways. There was a lot of talk about cast iron guarantees by the Irish government, for example. Now, if the Irish government learns its history, it will know that cast iron guarantees are rarely cast iron guarantees, and that there's a need to be very careful and very circumspect. There was always, as well, for me, a sense that EU solidarity, which is another one of the mantras around supporting Ireland, that could be short-lived. That when people begin to talk about creative solutions to the backstop dilemma, that it's an indication that the Republic needs to be careful about the durability of EU solidarity, because at the end of the day, we are a very minor player in a much larger EU, and that EU is not some kind of cuddly welfare organisation that's going to draw Ireland close to its bosom in perpetuity. So I was conscious of that. One of the reasons why some of the great failings, I think, of the EU have been neglected in the last 2 years is precisely because of Brexit, because we've become understandably so fixated on the backstop issue and the difficulties around the border that we've forgotten some of the reasons why the EU had become so problematic for many. And there is a parallel issue then, of course, about Britain still trying to find its way in the post-Second World War world and where it fits into the international order. And it had always been an awkward partner of the EEC, as it was then, subsequently the EU. So the Brexit result did not surprise me, given that weight of history and Britain's difficulties with regard to membership of the EU. So it was about really trying to give a longer perspective and a wider perspective to all of those issues that were swirling around as current affairs, but also to delineate a coherent narrative and to try and focus on the light rather than the heat.
Thank you very much, Dermot. It was a pleasure.
All right,
thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers.